ways. There was probably a penetration agent within CIA, for example, but his code name, Trumpet, was all Zaitsev knew. Even the data he transmitted were concealed by the use of layered super-encryption, including a one-time pad. But the data went to a colonel on the sixth floor who specialized in CIA investigations and worked closely with the second chief directorate. So, by implication, Trumpet was giving KGB something in which the second directorate was interested, and that meant agents operating for CIA right here in Moscow. Which was enough to give him chills, but the Americans he'd talked to, he'd warned them about communications security, and that would flag any dispatch about him to a very limited number of people. And he knew that Trumpet was being paid huge amounts of money, and so, probably he was not a senior CIA official, who, Zaitsev judged, were probably very well paid. An ideological agent would have given him cause to worry, but there were none of them in America whom he knew about. And he would know, wouldn't he? In a week, perhaps less, the communicator told himself, he'd be in the West and safe. He hoped his wife would not go totally amok when he told her his plans, but probably she would not. She had no immediate family. Her mother had died the previous year, to Irina's great sorrow, and she had neither brothers nor sisters to hold her back. And she was not happy working at GUM because of all the petty corruption there. And he would promise to get her the piano she longed to have, but which even his KGB post couldn't get for her. So meager was the supply. So he shuffled his papers, perhaps more slowly than usual, but not greatly so, he thought. There were few really hard workers, even in KGB. The cynical adage in the Soviet Union was, as long as they pretend to pay us, we will pretend to work. And the principle applied here as well. If you exceeded your quota, they'd just increase it the following year without any improvement in your working conditions. And so, few worked hard enough to be noticed as heroes of socialist labor. Just after 11 o'clock, Colonel Rozhdestvensky appeared in the comms room. Zaitsev caught his eye and waved him over. "Yes, Comrade Major," the colonel asked. "Comrade Colonel," he said quietly, "there have been no recent communications about 666. Is there anything I need to know?" The question took Rozhdestvensky aback. "Why do you ask?" "Comrade Colonel," Zaitsev went on humbly, "it was my understanding that this operation is important, and that I am the only communicator cleared for it. Have I acted improperly in any way?"
"Ah," Rozhdestvensky relaxed. "No, Comrade Colonel, we have no complaints with your activities. The operation no longer requires communications of this type."
"I see. Thank you, Comrade Colonel."
"You look tired, Major Zaitsev. Is anything the matter?"
"No, Comrade. I suppose I could use a vacation. I didn't get to go anywhere during the summer. A week or two off duty would be a blessing before the winter hits."
"Very well. If you have any difficulties, let me know, and I'll try to smooth things out for you."
Zaitsev managed a grateful smile.
"Why, thank you, Comrade Colonel."
"You do good work down here, Zaitsev. We're all entitled to some time off. Even state security people."
"Thank you again, Comrade Colonel.
I serve the Soviet Union."
Rozhdestvensky nodded and took his leave. As he walked out the door, Zaitsev took a long breath and went back to work, memorizing dispatches. But not for the Soviet Union. So, he thought, 666 was being handled by courier now. He'd learn no more about it, but he'd just learned that it was going forward on a high-priority basis. They were really going to do it. He wondered if the Americans would get him out quickly enough to forestall it. The information was in his hands, but the ability to do anything about it was not. It was like being Cassandra of old, daughter of King Priam of Troy, knowing what was going to happen, but unable to get anyone to do anything about it. Cassandra had angered the gods somehow or other, and received that curse as a result. But what had he done to deserve it, Zaitsev wondered, suddenly angry at CIA's inefficiency. But he couldn't just board a Pan-American flight out of Sheremetyevo International Airport, could he? Chapter 22. Procurements and Arrangements. The second face-to-face meeting was back at Gum Department Store, where a certain little bunny needed some fall-winter clothing, which her father wanted to get her, which was something of a surprise for Irina Bogdanova, but a pleasant one. Mary Pat, the supreme expert on shopping in the Foley family, wandered about looking at the various items on sale, surprised to see that they weren't all Soviet schlock. Some were even attractive, though not quite attractive enough to buy. She dawdled again in the fur department. The furs here might have sold fairly well in New York, though they were not quite on a par with Fendi. There weren't enough Italian designers in Russia. But the quality of the furs, that is, the animal skins themselves, wasn't too shabby. The Soviets just didn't know how to sew them together properly. That was too bad, really, she thought. The saddest thing about the Soviet Union was how the government of that gray country prevented its citizens from actually accomplishing much. There was so little originality here. The best things to buy were all old, pre-revolutionary artworks, usually small ones, almost always religious pieces, sold at impromptu flea markets to raise needed money for some family or other. She'd already purchased several pieces, trying not to feel like a thief in doing so. To assuage her conscience, she never haggled, almost always paying the price asked instead of trying to chisel it down by a few percent. That would have been like armed robbery, she thought, and her ultimate mission in Moscow, this was a core belief for her, was to help these people, though in a way they could hardly have understood or approved. But for the most part, Muscovites liked her American smile and friendliness. And certainly they liked the blue-stripe certificate rubles she paid with, cash money that would give them access to luxury items, or, almost as good, cash that they could exchange at a rate of 3 or 4 to 1. She wandered about for half an hour, then saw her target in the children's clothing area. She maneuvered that way, taking time to lift and examine various items before coming up behind him. "Good evening, Oleg Ivanich," she said quietly, handling a parka meant for a girl of 3 or 4.
"Mary, is it?"
"That is correct."
"Tell me, do you have any vacation days available to you?"
"Yes, I do. 2 weeks of it, in fact."
"And you told me that your wife likes classical music?"
"It is also correct."
"There is a fine conductor. His name is Josef Rocha. He will start performing in the main concert hall in Budapest on Sunday evening. The best hotel for you to check into is the Astoria. It is a short distance from the train station and is popular with Soviet guests. Tell all your friends what you are doing. Arrange to buy them things in Budapest. Do everything that a Soviet citizen does. We will handle the rest," she assured him.
"All of us," Zaitsev reminded her. "All of us come out."
"Of course, Oleg. Your little Zaitchik will see many wonders in America, and the winters are not so fierce as they are here," MP added.
"We Russians enjoy our winters," he pointed out with a little amour propre.
"In that case, you will be able to live in an area as cold as Moscow. And if you desire warm weather in February, you can drive or fly to Florida and relax on a sunny beach."
"You are tourist agent Mary?" the rabbit asked.
"For you, Oleg, I am just that. Are you comfortable passing information to my husband on the metro?"
"Yes."
You shouldn't be, Mary Pat thought. What is your best necktie?
A blue one with red stripes.
Very well. Wear that one 2 days before you take the train to Budapest. Bump into him and apologize, and we will know. 2 days before you leave Moscow, wear your blue-striped tie and bump into him on the metro, she repeated. You had to be careful doing this. People could make the goddamnedest mistakes in the simplest of matters, especially when their lives were on the line. That was why she was making it as easy as possible. Only one thing to remember. Only one thing to do.
Duh, I can do that easily.
Optimistic bastard, aren't you? Excellent. Please be very careful, Oleg Ivanovich. And with that, she went on her way. But then she stopped 5 or 6 meters away and turned. In her purse was a Minox camera. She shot 5 frames and then walked away.
Well, didn't you see anything worth getting? Her husband asked, out in their used Mercedes 280.
No, nothing really worthwhile. Maybe we should try a trip up to Helsinki to get some winter stuff, she suggested. You know, take the train, like. Ought to be fun to do it that way. Eddie should like it.
The station chief's eyebrow went up. Probably better to take the train, he thought. Doesn't look rushed or forced. Carry lots of suitcases, half of them empty, to bring back all the shit you'll buy there with your Comic-Con rubles, Ed Foley thought. Except you don't come back. And if Langley and London get their shit together, maybe we can make it a real home run ball.
Home, honey? Foley asked.
Wouldn't it be a hoot if KGB didn't have their home and car bugged, and they were doing all this secret agent crap for no reason at all? He thought idly. Well, at worst, it was good practice, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've done enough for one day.
Bloody hell, Basil Charleston breathed. He lifted his phone and punched 3 buttons. Yes, sir, Kingshot asked, coming into the room. This. C handed the dispatch across.
Shit, Kingshot breathed.
Sir Basil managed to smile.
It's always the obvious, simple things, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Even so, it does make one feel rather thick, he admitted.
A house fire.
Works better than what we originally thought.
Well, something to remember.
How many house fires did we have in London, Alan?
Sir Basil, I have not a clue, the most senior field spook in the SIS admitted, but find out I shall.
Get this to your friend Nolan as well?
Tomorrow morning, sir, Kingshot promised. At least it improves our chances. Our CIA working on this as well?
Yes.
As was the FBI. Director Emil Jacobs had heard his share of oddball requests from the folks on the other side of the river, as CIA was sometimes called in official Washington. But this was positively gruesome. He lifted his phone and punched his direct line to the DCI.
"There's a good reason for this, I presume, Arthur?" he asked, without preamble.
"Not over the phone, Emil, but yes."
3 Caucasians, 1 male in his early 30s, 1 female, same age, and a little girl, aged 3 or 4, Jacobs said, reading it off the hand-delivered note from Langley.
My field agents will think the director slipped a major gear, Arthur.
We'd probably be better off asking local police forces for assistance.
But, yes, I know, it would leak too quickly. Okay, I can send a message to all my SACs and have them check their morning papers, but it won't be easy to keep something like this from leaking out.
Emil, I understand that.
We're trying to get help from the Brits on this as well. Not the sort of thing you can just whistle up, I know. All I can say is that it's very important, Emil.
You due on the Hill any time soon?
House Intelligence Committee tomorrow at 10. Budget stuff, Moore explained.
Congress was always going after that information, and Moore always had to defend his agency from people on the Hill, who would just as soon cut CIA off at the ankles, so that they could complain about intelligence failures later on, of course. Okay, can you stop off here on the way? I gotta hear this cock-and-bull story, Jacobs announced. 8:40 or so. Works for me, Arthur. See you then, Moore promised. Director Jacobs replaced his phone, wondering what could be so goddamned important as to request the Federal Bureau of Investigation to play grave robber. On the metro home, after buying his little Zaitchik a white parka with red and green flowers on it, Zaitsev thought over his strategy. When would he tell Irina about their impromptu vacation? If he sprang it on her as a surprise, there would be one sort of problem. Irina would worry about her accounting job at GUM. But the office was, by her account, so loosely run that they'd hardly notice a missing body. But if he did give her too much warning, there would be another problem. She'd try to micromanage everything, like every wife in the known world, since, in her mind, he was unfitted to figure out anything. That was rather amusing, Oleg Ivanich thought, given the current circumstances. So then, no, he would not tell her ahead of time, but instead spring this trip on her as a surprise, and use this Hungarian conductor as the excuse. Then the big surprise would come in Budapest. He wondered how she'd react to that piece of news. Perhaps not well, but she was a Russian wife, trained and educated to accept the orders of her man, which, all Russian men thought, was as it should be. Svetlana loved riding the metro. That was the thing with little children, Oleg had learned. To them, everything was an adventure to take in with their wide children's eyes, even something as routine as riding the underground train. She didn't walk or run. She pranced like a puppy. Or like a bunny, her father thought, smiling down at her. Would his little Zaitchik find better adventures in the West? Probably so. If I get her there alive, Zaitsev reminded himself. There was danger involved, but somehow his fear was not for himself, but for his daughter. How odd that was. Or was it? He didn't know anymore. He knew that he had a mission of sorts, and that was all that he actually saw before him. The rest of it was just a collection of intermediate steps, but at the end of the steps was a bright, shining light, and that was all he could really see. It was very strange how the light had grown brighter and brighter since his first doubts about Operation 666 until now, when it occupied all his mental eyes could see. Like a moth drawn to a light, he kept circling in closer and closer, and all he could really hope was that the light was not a flame that would kill him. "Here, Papa," Svetlana said, recognizing their stop, taking his hand and dragging him forward to the sliding doors. A minute later she jumped on the moving steps of the escalator, excited by that ride as well. His child was like an American adult, or how Russians supposed them to be, always seeing opportunities and possibilities and the fun to be had, instead of the dangers and threats that careful, sober Soviet citizens saw everywhere. But if Americans were so foolish, why were Soviets always trying and failing to catch up with them? Was America really right where the USSR was so often wrong? It was a deeper question that he'd scarcely considered. All he knew of America was the obvious propaganda he saw every night on television, or read about in the official state newspapers. He knew that had to be wrong, but his knowledge was unbalanced, since he did not really know true information. And so his leap to the West was fundamentally a leap of faith. If his country was so wrong, then the alternative superpower had to be right. It was a big, long and dangerous leap, he thought, walking down the sidewalk and holding his little girl's hand. He told himself that he ought to be more fearful. But it was too late to be frightened, and turning back would have been as harmful to him as going forward. Above everything else, it was a question of who would destroy him, his country or himself, if he failed to carry out his mission. And on the other side, would America reward him for trying to do what he deemed the right thing? It seemed that he was like Lenin and the other revolutionary heroes. He saw something that was objectively wrong, and he was going to try to prevent it. Why? Because he had to. He had to trust that his country's enemies would see right and wrong as he did. Would they? While the American president had denounced his nation as the focus of all the evil in the world, his country said much the same thing of America. Who was right? Who was wrong? But it was his country and his employer that was conspiring to murder an innocent man. And that was as far as he could see into the right-wrong question. As Oleg and Svetlana turned left to go into their apartment building, he recognized one final time that his course was set. He could not change it, but could only toss the dice and wait to see how they came up. And where would his daughter grow up? That also rested on the flying dice. It happened first in York, the largest city in northern England. Fire safety engineers tell everyone who will listen that the least important thing about fires is what causes them to start, because they always start for the same reasons. In this case, it was the one that firefighters most hate to discover. Owen Williams, after a friendly night at his favorite pub, the Brown Lion, managed to down 6 pints of dark beer, which, added to a lengthy and tiring day working his job as a carpenter, had made him rather sleepy by the time he got to his third-floor flat. But that didn't stop him from switching on the TV in his bedroom and lighting a final cigarette of the day. His head propped up on a plumped pillow, he took a few puffs before fading out from the alcohol and the day's hard work. When that happened, his hand relaxed and the cigarette fell onto the bedclothes. There it smoldered for about 10 minutes before the white cotton sheets started to burn. Since Williams was unmarried, his wife had divorced him a year before, there was no one nearby to take note of the acrid, evil smell, and gradually the smoke wafted up to the ceiling as the low-level fire progressively consumed the bedclothes and then the mattress. People rarely die from fire, and neither did Owen Williams. Instead, he started breathing in the smoke. Smoke, engineers often use the term fire gas, mainly consists of hot air, carbon monoxide, and soot particles, which are unburned material from the fire's fuel. Of these, the carbon monoxide is often the deadliest component, since it forms a bond with the red blood cells. This bond is actually stronger than the bond that hemoglobin forms with the free oxygen that the blood conveys to the various parts of the human body. The overall effect on the human consciousness is rather like that of alcohol. Euphoria, like being pleasantly drunk, followed by unconsciousness, and if it goes too far, as in this case, death from oxygen starvation of the brain. And so, with a fire all around him, Owen Williams never woke. Only fell deeper and deeper into a sleep that took him peacefully into eternity at the age of 32 years. It wasn't until 3 hours later that a shift worker who lived on the same floor came home from work and noticed a smell in the third floor corridor that lit up his internal alarm lights. He pounded on the door and, getting no response, ran to his own flat and dialed 999. There was a firehouse only 6 blocks away, and there, as with any other such house in the world, the firefighters rolled out of their military-style single beds, pulled on their boots and their turnout coats, slid down the brass rail to the apparatus floor, punched the button to lift the automatic doors, and raced out on the street in their Dennis pumper, followed by a ladder truck. The drivers both knew the streets as well as any taxi driver and arrived at the apartment building less than 10 minutes after their bells had chimed them awake. The pumper crew halted their vehicle, and 2 men dragged the draft hoses to the corner fire hydrant,
charging the line in a skillful and well-practiced drill. The ladder men, whose primary job was search and rescue, raced inside to find that the concerned citizen who'd called in the alarm had already pounded on every door on the third floor and gotten his neighbors awake and out of their apartments. He pointed the lead fireman to the correct door, and that burly individual knocked it down with two powerful swings of his axe. He was greeted by a dense cloud of black smoke, the smell of which got past his air mask and immediately announced mattress to his experienced mind. This was followed by a quick prayer that they'd gotten here in time, and then instant dread that they had not. Everything, including the time of day, was against them in the dark, early morning. He ran into the back bedroom, smashed out the windows with his steel axe to vent the smoke outside, and then turned to see what he'd seen 30 or more times before. A human form, nearly hidden by the smoke and not moving. By then, two more of his colleagues were in the room. They dragged Owen Williams out into the corridor. "Oh, shit," one of them observed. The senior paramedic on the crew put an oxygen mask on the colorless face and started hitting the button to force pure oxygen into the lungs, and a second man began pounding on the victim's chest to get his heart restarted, while, behind them, the engine men snaked a 2.5-inch hose into the flat and started spraying water. All in all, it was a textbook exercise. The fire was snuffed out in less than 3 minutes. Soon thereafter, the smoke had largely cleared, and the firemen took off their protective air masks. But out in the corridor, Owen Williams showed not a flicker of life. The rule was that nobody was dead until a physician said so, and so they carried the body like a large and heavy limp rag to the white ambulance sitting on the street. The paramedic crew had their own battle drill, and they followed it to the letter, first putting the body on their gurney, then checking his eyes, then his airway. It was clear, and using their ventilator to get more oxygen into him, plus more CPR to get the heart moving. The peripheral burns would have to wait. The first thing to be done was to get the heart beating and lungs breathing as the driver pulled out onto the darkened streets for Queen Victoria Hospital, just more than a mile away. But by the time they got there, the paramedics in the back knew that it was just a waste of their highly valuable time. The casualty-receiving area was ready for them. The driver reversed direction and backed in. The rear doors were wrenched open, and the gurney was wheeled out, with a young doctor observing but not touching anything yet. "Smoke inhalation," the fireman paramedic said on coming in the swinging doors. "Severe carbon monoxide intoxication." The extensive but mainly superficial burns could wait for the moment. "How long?" the ER doc asked at once. "Don't know. It does not look good, doctor. CO poisoning, eyes fixed and dilated, fingernails red. No response to CPR or oxygen as yet," the paramedic reported. The medics all tried. You don't just kiss off the life of a man in his early 30s. But an hour later it was clear that Owen Williams would not open his blue eyes ever again, and on the doctor's command, life-saving efforts were stopped and a time of death announced to be typed in on the death certificate. The police were there also, of course. They mostly chatted with the firemen until the cause of death was established. The blood chemistry was taken. They'd drawn blood immediately to check blood gases, and after 15 minutes, the lab reported that the level of carbon monoxide was 39%, deep into the lethal range. He'd been dead before the firemen had rolled off their cots. And that was that. It was the police, rather than the firemen, who took it from there. A man had died, and it had to be reported up the chain of command. That chain ended in London, in the steel and glass building that was New Scotland Yard, with its revolving triangular sign that made tourists think that the name of the London police force was, in fact, Scotland Yard, when actually that had been a street name years before for the old headquarters building. There, a post-it note on a teletype machine announced that Chief Superintendent Nolan of Special Branch wanted to be informed at once of any death by fire or accident, and the teletype operator lifted a phone and called the appropriate number.
That number was to the Special Branch Watch Officer, who asked a few questions, then called York for further information. Then it was his job to awaken Tiny Nolan just after 4 a.m.
"Very well," the Chief Superintendent said after collecting himself. "Tell them to do nothing whatsoever with the body. Nothing at all. Make sure they understand. Nothing at all."
"Very well, sir," the sergeant in the office confirmed.
"I will relay that."
And 7 miles away, Patrick Nolan went back to sleep. Or at least tried to, while his mind wondered again what the hell SIS wanted a roasted human body for. It had to be something interesting, just that it was also quite disgusting to contemplate. Enough that it denied him sleep for 20 minutes or so, before he faded back out. The messages were flying back and forth across the Atlantic and Eastern Europe all that night, and all of them were processed by the signals specialists in the various embassies, the underpaid and overworked clerical people who, virtually alone, were needed to transmit all of the most sensitive information from originators to end users. And so, virtually alone, were the people who knew it all but did nothing with it. They were also the ones whom enemies tried so hard to corrupt, and who were, as a result, the most carefully watched of all staffers, whether at headquarters or in the various embassies, though for all the concern there was usually no compensating solicitude for their comfort. But it was through these so often unappreciated but vital people that the dispatches found their way to the proper desks. One recipient was Nigel Haydock, and it was to him that the most important of the morning's messages went, because only he at this moment knew the scope of Beatrix there in his office, where he was covered as commercial attaché to Her Britannic Majesty's Embassy on the eastern bank of the Moscow River. Haydock usually took his breakfast at the embassy, since, with his wife so gravidly pregnant, he felt it improper for him to have her fix the morning meal for him. And besides, she was sleeping a lot, in preparation for not sleeping at all when the little bugger arrived, Nigel thought. So there he was at his desk, drinking his morning tea and eating a buttered muffin when he got to the dispatch from London.
"Bloody hell," he breathed, then paused to think. It was brilliant, this American play on mincemeat. Nasty and grisly, but brilliant. And it appeared that Sir Basil was going forward with it. That tricky old bugger. It was the sort of thing Baz would like. The current C was a devotee of the old school, one who liked the feel of devious operations. His over-cleverness might be the downfall of him some day, but, Haydock thought, one has to admire his panache. So get the rabbit to Budapest and arrange his escape from there.
Andy Hudson preferred coffee in the morning, accompanied by eggs, bacon, fried tomatoes, and toast.
"Bloody brilliant," he said aloud.
The audacity of this operation appealed to his adventurous nature. So they'd have to get 3 individuals, an adult male, an adult female, and a little girl, all out of Hungary covertly. Not overly difficult, but he'd have to check his rat line, because this was one operation he didn't want to bollocks up, especially if he had thoughts of promotion in the future. The Secret Intelligence Service was singular among British government bureaucracies insofar as, while it rewarded success fairly well, it was singularly unforgiving of failure. There was no union at Century House to protect the worker bees. But he'd known that going in, and they couldn't take his pension away in any case. Once he had the seniority to qualify for one, Hudson cautioned himself. But while this operation wasn't quite the World Cup, it would be rather like scoring the winning goal for Arsenal against Manchester United at Wembley Stadium. So his first task of the day was to see after his cross-border connections. Those were reliable, he thought. He'd spent a good deal of time setting them up, and he'd checked them out before. But he'd check them out again, starting today. He'd also check in with his AVH contact.
Or would he, Hudson wondered. What would that get him? It could allow him to find out if the Hungarian secret police force was on a state of alert or looking for something. But if that were true, the rabbit would not be leaving Moscow. His information had to be highly important for an operation of this complexity to be run by CIA through SIS, and KGB was too careful and conservative an agency to take any sort of chances with information of that importance. The other side was never predictable in the intelligence business. There were just too many people with slightly different ideas for everyone to operate in lockstep. So, no, AVH wouldn't know very much, if anything at all. KGB trusted no one at all, absent direct oversight, preferably with guns. So the only smart thing for him to do would be to look in on his escape procedures, and even to do that circumspectly, and otherwise wait for this Ryan chap to arrive from London to look over his shoulder. Ryan, he thought. CIA. The same one who... No chance of that. Just a coincidence. Had to be. That Ryan was a bootneck. An American bootneck. Just too much of a coincidence, the COS Budapest decided. Ryan had remembered his croissants, and this time he'd taken them with him in the cab from Victoria to Century House, along with the coffee. He arrived to see Simon's coat on the tree, but no Simon. Probably off with Sir Basil, he decided, and sat down at his desk, looking at the pile of overnights to go through. The croissants, he'd pigged out and bought three of them, plus butter and grape jelly packets, were sufficiently flaky that he risked ending up wearing them instead of eating them, and this morning's coffee wasn't half bad. He made a mental note to write to Starbucks and suggest that they open some outlets in London. The Brits needed good coffee to get them off their damn tea, and this new Seattle company might just pull it off, assuming they could train people to brew it upright. He looked up when the door opened. Morning, Jack.
Hey, Simon. How's Sir Basil this morning?
He's feeling very clever indeed with this Operation Beatrix.
It's underway, in a manner of speaking.
Can you fill me in on what's happening?
Simon Harding thought for a moment, then explained briefly.
Is somebody out of his fucking mind? Ryan demanded at the conclusion of the mini-brief.
Jack? Yes, it is creative, Harding agreed. But there should be little in the way of operational difficulties.
Unless I barf, Jack responded darkly.
So take a plastic bag, Harding suggested. Take one from the airplane with you.
Funny, Simon. Ryan paused.
What is this? Some sort of initiation ceremony for me?
No, we don't do that sort of thing.
The operational concept comes from your people, and the request for cooperation comes from Judge Moore himself.
Fuck, Jack observed. And they dumped me in the shitter, huh?
Jack, the objective here is not merely to get the rabbit out, but to do so in such a way as to make Ivan believe he's dead, not defected, along with his wife and daughter. Actually, the part that bothered Ryan was the corpses. What could be more distasteful than that?
And he doesn't even know the nasty part yet, Simon Harding thought, glad that he'd edited that part out.
Zaitsev walked into the administrative office on the center's second floor. He showed his ID to the girl and waited a few minutes before going into the supervisor's office.
Yes, the bureaucrat said, only half looking up. I wish to take my vacation days. I want to take my wife to Budapest. There's a conductor there she wants to hear, and I wish to travel there by train instead of by air.
When?
In the next few days. As soon as possible, in fact.
I see.
The KGB's travel office did many things, most of them totally mundane. The travel agent, what else could Zaitsev call him, still didn't look up.
I must check the availability of space on the train.
I want to travel international class. Compartments. Beds for three. I have a child, you see.
That may not be easy, the bureaucrat noted.
Comrade, if there are any difficulties, please contact Colonel Rozhdestvensky, he said mildly.
That name caused him to look up, Zaitsev saw.
The only question was whether or not he'd make the call. The average desk sitter did not go out of his way to become known to a senior official, and, like most people in the center, he had a healthy fear of those on the top floor. On the one hand, he might want to see if someone were taking the colonel's name in vain. On the other hand, calling his attention to that senior officer as an officious little worm in administration would do him little good. He looked at Zaitsev, wondering if he had authorization to invoke Rozhdestvensky's name and authority.
I will see what I can do, Comrade Captain, he promised.
When can I call you?
Later today.
Thank you, comrade. Zaitsev walked out and down the corridor to the elevators.
So, that was done, thanks to his temporary patron on the top floor. To make sure everything was all right, he had his blue striped tie folded and in his coat pocket. Back at his desk, he went back to memorizing the content of his routine message traffic. A pity, he thought, that he could not copy out of the one-time pad books. But that was not practical, and memorizing them was a sheer impossibility, even for his trained memory.
Approved was the single word on the message from Langley, Foley saw. So, they were going forward. That was good. Headquarters was hot to trot on Beatrix, and that was probably because the rabbit had warned them about general communications security. The one thing sure to cause a general panic on the seventh floor at headquarters. But could it possibly be true? No. Mike Russell didn't think so, and as he'd already observed, were it true, some of his agents would have been swept up like confetti after a parade, and that hadn't happened. Unless KGB was really being clever and had doubled his agents, operating them under Soviet control, and he'd be able to determine that, wouldn't he? Well, probably, Foley judged. Certainly they could not all be double agents. Some things were just impossible to hide. Unless KGB's second chief directorate had the cleverest operation in the history of espionage, and while that was theoretically possible, it was the tallest of tall orders, and something that they'd probably avoid since the quality of some information going out would have to be good. Too good to let go voluntarily. But he couldn't entirely discount that possibility. For sure, NSA would be taking steps right now to examine their KH-7 and other cipher machines. But Fort Meade had a very active red team whose only job was to crack their own systems. And while Russian mathematicians were pretty smart, always had been, they weren't aliens from another planet. Unless they had an agent of their own deep inside Fort Meade, and that was a worry that everyone had. How much would KGB pay for that sort of information? Millions, perhaps. They didn't have all that much cash to pay their people, and in addition to being niggardly, KGB was singularly disloyal to its people, regarding them all as expendable assets. Oh, sure, they got Kim Philby out and safely ensconced in Moscow. The Western spy agencies knew where he lived and had even photographed the turncoat bastard. They even knew how much he drank. A lot, even by Russian standards. But when the Russians lost an agent to arrest, did they ever try to bargain for him? Do a trade? No. Not since CIA had bargained for Francis Gary Powers, the unlucky U-2 pilot whom they'd shot down in 1961 and then traded for Rudolf Abel. But Abel had been one of their own officers, a colonel and a pretty good one, operating in New York.
That had to be a deterrent to any American national in the spook business who had illusions of getting rich off Mother Russia's bank account. And traitors did hard time in the federal prison system, which had to be one hell of a deterrent. But traitors were real, however misguided they were. At least the age of the ideological spy was largely ended. Those had been the most productive and the most dedicated, back when people really had believed that communism was the leading wave of human evolution. But even Russians no longer believed in Marxism-Leninism, except for Suslov, who was just about dead, and his successor-to-be, Alexandrov. So, no. KGB agents in the West were almost entirely mercenary bastards. Not the freedom fighters Ed Foley ran on the streets of Moscow, the COS told himself. That was an illusion all CIA officers held dearly. Even his wife. And the rabbit? He was mad about something. A murder, he said. A proposed killing. Something that offended the sense of an honorable and decent man. So, yes, the rabbit was honorable in his motivations and therefore worthy of CIA's attention and solicitude. Jesus, Ed Foley thought, the illusions you have to carry on this stupid fucking business. You had to be psychiatrist, loving mother, stern father, close friend, and father confessor to the idealistic, confused, angry, or just plain greedy individuals who chose to betray their country. Some of them drank too much. Some of them were so enraged that they endangered themselves by taking grotesque risks. Some were just plain mad, demented, clinically disturbed. Some became sexual deviants. Hell, some started off that way and just got worse. But Ed Foley had to be their social worker, which was such an odd job description for someone who thought of himself as a warrior against the big, ugly bear. Well, he told himself, one thing at a time. He'd knowingly chosen a profession with barely adequate pay, virtually no credit ever to be awarded, and no recognition for the dangers, physical and psychological, that attended it, serving his country in a way that would never be appreciated by the millions of citizens he helped to protect, despised by the news media, whom he in turn despised, and never being able to defend himself with the truth of what he did. What a hell of a life. But it did have its satisfactions, like getting the rabbit the hell out of Dodge City. If Beatrix worked. Foley told himself that now, once more, he knew what it was like to pitch in the World Series. István Kovács lived a few blocks from the Hungarian Parliamentary Palace, an ornate building reminiscent of the Palace of Westminster, on the third floor of a turn-of-the-century tenement, whose four toilets were on the first floor of a singularly dreary courtyard. Hudson took the local metro over to the government palace and walked the rest of the way, making sure that he didn't have a tail. He'd called ahead. Remarkably, the city's phone lines were secure, uncontrolled mainly because of the inefficiency of the local phone systems. Kovács was so typically Hungarian as to deserve a photo in the non-existent tourist brochures. 5'8", swarthy, a mainly circular face with brown eyes and black hair. But he dressed rather better than the average citizen because of his profession. Kovács was a smuggler. It was almost an honored livelihood in this country, since he traded across the border to a putatively Marxist country to the south, Yugoslavia, whose borders were open enough that a clever man could purchase Western goods there and sell them in Hungary and the rest of Eastern Europe. The border controls on Yugoslavia were fairly loose, especially for those who had an understanding with the border guards. Kovács was one such person. "Hello, István," Andy Hudson said with a smile. István was the local version of Stephen, and Kovács the local version of Smith, for its ubiquity. "Andy, good day to you," Kovács replied in greeting.
He opened a bottle of Tokai, the local tawny wine made of grapes with the noble rot which afflicted them every few years. Hudson had come to enjoy it as the local variant of sherry, with a different taste, but an identical purpose.
Thank you, Istvan. Hudson took a sip. This was good stuff, with six baskets of nobly rotten grapes on the label, indicating the very best. So how is business?
Excellent. Our VCRs are popular with the Yugoslavs, and the tapes they sell me are popular with everyone. Oh, to have such a prick as those actors do.
He laughed.
The women aren't bad either, Hudson noted. He'd seen his share of such tapes.
How can a Kurova be so beautiful?
The Americans pay their whores more than we do in Europe, I suppose.
But, Istvan, they have no heart, those women.
Hudson had never paid for it in his life.
At least not up front.
It's not their hearts that I want.
Kovach had himself another hearty laugh. He'd been hitting the Tokai already this day, so he wasn't making a run tonight.
Well, nobody worked all the time. I may have a task for you.
Bringing what in?
Nothing. Bringing something out, Hudson clarified.
That is simple. What trouble the Atarzeg give us is when we come in. And then, not much.
He held up his right hand, rubbing thumb and forefinger together in the universal gesture for what the border guards wanted. Money, or something negotiable.
Well, this package might be bulky, Hudson warned.
How bulky? A tank you want to take out?
The Hungarian army had just taken delivery of new Russian T-72s, and that had made the TV, in an attempt to buck up the fighting spirit of the troops.
A waste of time, Hudson thought. That might be hard, but it can be done, for a price.
But the Poles had already given one of those to SIS, a fact not widely known.
No, Istvan, smaller than that.
About my size, but three packages.
Three people, Kovach asked, getting a dull stare in return.
He got the message.
Ah, a simple task.
Bajd Meg, he concluded.
Fuck it.
I thought I could count on you, Istvan, Hudson said with a smile.
How much?
For three people into Yugoslavia.
Kovach pondered that for a moment.
Oh, 5,000 D-mark.
As Kurva Draga, Hudson objected, or ostensibly so.
It was cheap at the price, hardly 1,000 quid.
Very well, you thief. I'll pay it because you are my friend, but just this one time.
He finished his drink.
You know, I could just fly the packages out, Hudson suggested.
But the airport is the one place where the Atarzeg are alert, Kovach pointed out. The poor bastards are always in the lights with their senior officers about. No chance for them to be open to negotiations.
I suppose that is so, Hudson agreed.
Very well. I will call you to keep track of your schedule.
That is fine. You know where to find me.
Hudson stood. Thanks for the drink, my friend.
It lubricates the business, Kovach said as he opened the door for his guest. 5,000 West German marks would cover a lot of obligations and buy him a lot of goods to resell in Budapest for a handsome profit.
Chapter 23. All Aboard.
Zaitsev called the travel office at 15:30. He hoped that this didn't show an unusual eagerness, but everyone was interested in their vacation arrangements, he figured.
Comrade Major, you are on the train day after tomorrow. It leaves Kiev station at 13:30 and arrives in Budapest 2 days later at 14 hours exactly.
You and your family are booked into carriage 906 in compartments A and B. You are also booked into Budapest's Hotel Astoria, room 307, for 11 days. The hotel is directly across the street from the Soviet Culture and Friendship House, which is, of course, a KGB operation with a liaison office, should you need any local assistance.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your help.
Zaitsev thought for a moment. Is there anything I might purchase for you in Budapest?
Why, thank you, comrade.
His voice just lit up.
Yes, perhaps some pantyhose for my wife,
the functionary said in a furtive voice.
What size?
My wife is a real Russian, he replied, meaning decidedly not anorexic.
Very good. I will find something.
Or my wife will assist me.
Excellent. Have a grand trip.
Yes, I shall, Zaitsev promised him. With that settled, Oleg Ivanich left his desk and went to his watch supervisor to announce his plans for the coming 2 weeks.
Isn't there some upstairs project that only you are cleared for? The lieutenant colonel asked.
Yes, but I asked Colonel Rozhdestvensky, and he said not to be concerned about it.
Feel free to call him to confirm that, comrade, Zaitsev told him.
And he did, in Zaitsev's presence.
The brief call ended with a, thank you, comrade. And then he looked up at his subordinate.
Very well, Oleg Ivanich, you are relieved of your duties beginning this evening.
Say, while you are in Budapest.
Certainly, Andrei Vasilievich. You may pay me for them when I get back. Andrei was a decent boss who never screamed and helped his people when asked. A pity he worked for an agency that murdered innocent people. And then it was just a matter of cleaning up his desk, which wasn't difficult. KGB regulations dictated that every desk be set up exactly the same way, so that a worker could switch desks without confusion, and Zaitsev's desk was arranged exactly according to office specifications. With his pencils properly sharpened and lined up, his message log up to the moment, and all his books properly in place, he dumped his trash and walked to the men's room. There, he selected a stall, removed his brown tie, and replaced it with his striped one. He checked his watch. It was actually a little early. So Zaitsev took his time on the way out, smoked 2 cigarettes instead of one, and took a moment to enjoy the clear afternoon, stopping off to get a paper along the way, and, to pamper himself, 6 packs of Krasnobrezhnensky, the premium cigarette smoked by Leonid Brezhnev himself, for 2 rubles 40. Something nice to smoke on the train. Might as well spend his rubles now, he decided. They'd be valueless where he was going. Then he walked down to the metro station and checked the clock. The train, of course, came right on time. Foley was in the same place, doing the same thing in exactly the same way, his mind racing as the train slowed to a stop at this station. He felt the tiny vibration from the boarding passengers and the grunts of people bumping into one another. He straightened up to turn the page. Then the train lurched off. The engineers, or motormen, whatever the hell you called them, were always a little heavy on the throttle. A moment later, there was a presence to his left. Foley didn't see it, but he could feel it. 2 minutes later, the subway train slowed for another station. It lurched to a stop, and someone bumped into him. Foley turned slightly to see who it was.
"Excuse me, comrade," the rabbit said.
He was wearing a blue tie with red stripes.
"No problem," Foley responded dismissively, as his heart leapt inside his chest.
Okay. 2 days from now. Kiev station. The train to Budapest. The rabbit moved a step or two away, and that was that. The signal had been passed. Sky rockets in flight. Foley folded his paper and made his way to the sliding doors. The usual walk to his apartment. Mary Pat was fixing dinner.
Like my tie?
You didn't tell me this morning. MP's eyes lit up. Day after tomorrow, she realized. They'd have to get the word out, but that was just a procedural thing. She hoped Langley was ready. Beatrix was going a little fast, but why dawdle? So what's for dinner? Well, I wanted to get a steak, but I'm afraid you'll have to settle for fried chicken today. That's okay, honey. Steak for day after tomorrow, maybe, she asked. Sounds good to me. Honey, where's Eddie? Watching Transformers, of course. She pointed to the living room. That's my boy, Ed observed with a smile. He knows the important stuff. Foley kissed his wife tenderly. Later, Tiger, Mary Pat breathed back. But a successful operation merited a discreet celebration. Not that this one was successful yet, but it was certainly headed that way, and it was their first in Moscow. Got the pictures? She whispered. He pulled them out of his jacket pocket. They were not exactly magazine cover quality, but they did give good representations of the rabbit and his little bunny. They didn't know what Mrs. Rabbit looked like, but this would have to do. They'd get the shots to Nigel and Penny. One of them would cover the train station to make sure the rabbit family got going on time. Ed, there's a problem with the shower, Mary Pat said. The spray thingy isn't right. I'll see if Nigel has the right tools. Foley walked out the door and down the hall. In a few minutes, they were back, Nigel carrying his toolbox. Hello, Mary. Nigel waved on his way to the bathroom. Once there, he made a fuss about opening his toolbox, then turning on the water, and now any bug the KGB might have here was jammed. Okay, Ed, what is it? Ed handed over the photos. The rabbit and the bunny. We have nothing on Mrs. Rabbit yet. They'll all be taking the 1 p.m. train to Budapest, day after tomorrow. Kiev station, Haydock said with a nod. You will want me to get a picture of Mrs. Rabbit. Correct. Very well, I can do that. The wheels started turning at once. As commercial attaché, he could come up with a cock-and-bull story to cover it, Haydock reasoned. He'd get a tame reporter to accompany him and make it look like a news story. Something about tourism, perhaps. Paul Matthews of the Times would play along. Easily done. He'd have Matthews bring a photographer and take professional photos of the whole rabbit family for London and Langley to use. And Ivan shouldn't suspect a thing. However important the rabbit's information might be, the rabbit himself was just a cipher, one of many thousands of KGB employees not important enough to be taken any note of. So tomorrow morning, Haydock would call the Soviet State Railroad and say that the Soviet's sister service in Britain, which was also state-owned, was interested in how the Russians ran theirs. And so, yes, that would work. There was nothing the Soviets liked better than others wanting to learn from their glorious system. Good for their egos. Nigel reached over to turn off the water. There, I think that has it fixed, Edward. Thanks, pal. Any good places in Moscow to buy tools? I don't know, Ed. I've had these since I was a lad. Belonged to my father, you see. Then Foley remembered what had happened to Nigel's father. Yeah, he wanted Beatrix to succeed. He wanted to take every opportunity to shove a big one up the bear's hairy ass. How's Penny? The baby hasn't dropped yet, so at least another week, probably more. Strictly speaking, she isn't due for another 3 weeks, but the docs never get that one right, buddy. Never, Foley told his friend. Best advice, stay close. When you planning to fly home? 10 days should be about right, the embassy physician tells us. It's only a 2-hour flight, after all. Your doc is an optimist, pal. These things never go according to plan. I don't suppose you want a little Englishman to be born in Moscow, huh? No, Edward, we don't. Well,
Keep Penny off the trampoline, Foley suggested with a wink.
Yes, I will do that, Ed.
American humor could be rather crass, he thought. This could be interesting, Foley thought, walking his friend to the door. He'd always thought Brit children were born at the age of 5 and sent immediately off to boarding school. Did they raise them the same way Americans did?
He'd have to see.
The body of Owen Williams was never collected. It turned out he had no immediate family, and his ex-wife had no interest in him at all, especially dead. The local police, on receipt of a telex from Chief Superintendent Patrick Nolan of London's Metropolitan Police, transferred the body to an aluminum casket, which was loaded in a police van and driven south toward London. But not quite. The van stopped at a pre-selected location, and the aluminum box was transferred to another unmarked van for the drive into the city. It ended up in a mortuary in the Swiss Cottage District of North London. The body was not in very good shape, and since it had not yet seen a mortician, it had also not been treated in any way. The unburned underside was a blue-crimson shade of post-mortem lividity. Once the heart stops, the blood is pulled by gravity to the lower regions of the body, in this case, the back, where, lacking oxygen, it tends to turn the Caucasian body a pale bluish color, leaving the upper side with a disagreeable ivory pallor. The mortician here was a civilian who occasionally contracted specialty work to the Secret Intelligence Service. Along with a forensic pathologist, he examined the body for anything unusual. The worst thing was the smell of roasted human meat, but their noses were covered with surgical masks to attenuate the odor.
"Tattoo, underside of the forearm, partially but not entirely burned off," the mortician reported.
"Very well."
The pathologist lit the flame of a propane blowtorch and applied it to the arm, burning all evidence of the tattoo off the body.
"Anything else, William?"
he asked a couple minutes later.
"Nothing I can see. The upper body is well charred. Hair is mainly gone.
The smell of burned human hair is particularly vile.
And one ear nearly burned off. I presume this chap was dead before he burned."
"Ought to have been," the pathologist said.
"The blood gases had the CO well spiked into lethal range. I doubt this poor bugger felt a thing."
Then he burned off the fingerprints, lingering to sear both hands with the torch so that it would not appear to have been a deliberate mutilation of the body.
"There," the pathologist said finally. "If there's a way to identify this body, I do not know what it is."
"Freeze it now?" the undertaker asked.
"No, I don't think so.
If we chill it down to, 2 or 3 degrees Celsius, no noticeable decomposition ought to take place."
"Dry ice, then?"
"Yes. The metal casket is well insulated, and it seals hermetically.
Dry ice doesn't melt, you know.
It goes directly from a solid to a gas. Now, we need to get it dressed."
The doctor had brought the underclothing with him. None of it was British in origin, and all of it was badly damaged by fire. All in all, it was a distasteful job, but one that pathologists and morticians get used to very early in their professions. It was just a different way of thinking for a different kind of job. But this was unusually gruesome, even for these two. Both would have an extra drink before turning in that night. When they finished, the aluminum box was reloaded on the van and driven to Century House. There would be a note on Sir Basil's desk in the morning to let him know that Rabbit A was ready for his last flight. Later that night, and 3,000 miles away, in Boston, Massachusetts, there was a gas explosion on the second floor of a 2-story frame dwelling overlooking the harbor. 3 people were there when it happened. The 2 adults were not married, but both were drunk, and the woman's 4-year-old daughter, not related to the male resident, was already in bed. The fire spread quickly, too quickly for the 2 adults to respond to it through their intoxication. The 3 deaths didn't take long, all of them from smoke inhalation rather than incineration. The Boston Fire Department responded within 10 minutes, and their search and rescue laddermen battled their way through the flames under cover of 2 hose streams, found the bodies, and dragged them out. But they knew that they'd been too late again. The captain of the responding company could tell almost instantly what had gone wrong. There had been a gas leak in the kitchen from the old stove that the landlord hadn't wanted to replace, and so 3 people had died of his parsimony. He'd gladly collect the insurance check, of course, and say how sorry he was about the tragic incident. This was not the first such case. It wouldn't be the last, either, and so he and his men would have some nightmares about the 3 bodies, especially the little girls. But that just went with the job. The story was early enough to make the 11 o'clock news, on the rule that if it bleeds, it leads. The special agent in charge of the FBI's Boston Field Division was up and watching, actually waiting for coverage of the baseball playoffs. He'd been at an official dinner and missed the live broadcast on NBC, and saw the story and instantly remembered the lunatic telex he'd gotten earlier in the day. That caused a curse to be muttered and a phone to be lifted. FBI, said the young agent guarding the phones when he picked up. Get Johnny up, the SAC ordered. Family got burned up in a fire on Hester Street. He'll know what to do. Have him call me at home if he has to. Yes, sir. And that was that, except for Assistant Special Agent in Charge John Tyler, who'd been reading a book in his bed. A native of South Carolina, he preferred college football to professional baseball, when the phone rang. He managed to grumble on the way to the bathroom, then collected his sidearm and car keys for the ride south. He'd seen the telex from Washington, too, and wondered what sort of drugs Emil Jacobs was taking. But his was not to reason why.